And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends that have been playing D&D a long time. While we both love lots of other RPGs, D&D still has a lot of potential energy. Hi, I'm Ange, and I've been gaming for over 35 years. In 2014, I started writing for Gnome Stew, and I've been running the Gnomecast, the Stew's podcast, since 2017. And in 2021, they kind of put me in charge of stuff. So I'm the head gnome.
And I'm Jared, the review gnome at Gnome Stew, and I have seen 7 editions of D&D, and I am resting in the knowledge that there will never be another edition of D&D, because this is the last edition of D&D, and it'll just be iterated upon.
Oh, Jared.
In addition to writing reviews at Gnome Stew, I've got my own site, whatdoiknowjr.com, where I write additional reviews and opinion pieces on a variety of RPGs. After we look at the games that we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about what goes into making a homebrew setting. Then we'll have some recommendations of D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Now stand by for station identification. This is WDND The Role Player. Now we're going to McElroy McKinney and the Bardic College.
From the Bardic College. How many official Dungeons & Dragons settings have been published over the years? If official means published by the current owner of D&D, there are more than 35 settings, including some interesting familiar locations from beyond D&D's IPs, like the Conan Hyperborean Age, the movie version of Red Sonja's Sword, and the Blizzard properties of Diablo and Warcraft. But to be clear, Warcraft was a D&D setting briefly, but World of Warcraft was a D20 game using the 3rd edition SRD, and that Warcraft movie definitely isn't a D&D setting. Now, on another Warcraft note, the new expansion, The War Within, is coming out soon, and I, McElroy McKinney, will be playing it. I'll be a mage out there arcane blasting away. Enjoy the World of Warcraft.
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
So, campaign journal, while I got to take part in a session zero, Jared is going to talk about that since he's the GM. The only game I got to play since our last episode was recorded is another session of Cygnus de Yore, The Monkeys of War. We were deep in the buried tomb temple that we had been drawn to by the cursed shard that we've been carrying. In the last session, we had seen the woman in charge, the sister of the town's mayor, but when we tried to chase her down, she ran away from us, and we came upon a room where there were two of her at a table playing cards. We ended up knocking both of them out, and that's where we ended last session. We were pretty sure those two duplicates of her were doppelgangers, but because we knocked them out instead of just outright killing them, because I refuse to be a murder hobo, we don't know that for sure. So we picked up right where we left off, and this session pretty much was one long running fight. We searched the room. We had a moment where we basically kind of blocked entrances into the room we were in and took a moment to search things, and we found some letters that essentially kind of explained a little bit of what was going on and showed that the mayor's sister was definitely a bad guy. She was there to use up the people of the town as labor, and if what she did in the tomb destroyed the town, so be it. And there was something about a wizard coming in to help her with some other assistance, which we kind of surmised might be these two doppelgangers. Now, despite the session being one long fight, it was pretty fun because it took place in multiple different rooms, and we had a lot of opportunities to do cool things with the environment to try and mitigate the fighting of all of our henchmen at once. We had some fun stuff done with illusions and trying to trick people into going different directions. It was a tough fight. At one point, Selena, my fighter, who I mentioned last episode has Pathfinder levels of AC, was in the thick of a fight with a bunch of henchmen as a wizard hid in a nearby room and was taking magic missile pot shots at us. I told Bryn, our sorcerer, that it was okay for her to include me in the lightning bolt she wanted to cast because Selena could take it. But then almost right after that, Malcolm, our warlock, dropped a synaptic static on her, and that hurt. And it also, if you fail the save, which I think is an intelligence save, which she's got a headband of intellect, so she has a +4, but that's all she's got. And that gives you negatives to future roles. I basically roleplayed shouting a curse at Malcolm, but then I realized the curse I shouted at him was more of a real world curse. So I edited it to be like, "My cord's balls, Malcolm, that hurts." Immediately after he did that, the wizard in the other room dropped a fireball on us. And so Selena went down from that. She popped back up when I think Tad, our grung wrestler, and I use air quotes for that because he is like four or five different classes, but one of those classes is bard, so he has access to healing word. He popped Selena back up with 7 hit points, and then she immediately went down, back down again when I think we got hit with something else. I don't remember what it was at this point, but she was down, then she was up, then she was down, then she was back up, and she was pissed. To be fair, I was completely okay with this. Selena is really hard to hit, and I know that can be super frustrating for the GM. So her actually having to use her 100-plus hit points for something is totally worth it. We ended the fight after we took out the mayor's sister and then the wizard along with his clay golem, and all of the henchmen decided to surrender. That's where we ended because we were already past midnight. And unfortunately, the GM has the audacity to go on vacation, which means we are not going to be able to play for our next session. So I don't know what I'm going to have to talk about the next time we record.
Your area attack woes reminded me of this one session that we were playing where we went into a room and there were 2 flame skulls. First one throws a fireball at us and we were like, okay, I bet I know what the other flame skull is going to do. So we get hit by the second fireball. We didn't realize on the way in, we had apparently triggered an alarm. So further down the initiative track, a third flame skull comes into the room, at which point we were like, you have to be kidding me. We got hit with the third fireball of that round.
The thing about Selena is at some point I ended up picking up a feat that makes dexterity also one of her saving throws that she can use a proficiency bonus with. Mm. So she has her proficiency bonus added to all of her physical saving throws. It's those mental ones that are a little iffy. And she is literally the smartest person in the party with that dead band of intellect, to the point that Malcolm's player TJ was making fun of me for wanting to hang on to it. Like, oh, I'm the smartest person in the party. I can't take off the headband of intellect. Shut up.
Well, unfortunately, we didn't get to play last Thursday. We spent a little bit of time just hanging out, and we poked around Shard a little bit together, but we really didn't do a whole lot of note other than just hanging out and talking a little bit, but that was fine. On Saturday, we had a session 0. I am going to run a Tales of the Valiant, basically a test drive. It's going to be a regular campaign. It's going to be monthly, but I'm going to try not to put quite as much effort into that campaign as I do other things. And it's going to be a little bit more lightly engaged so that we can just see what the rules are like. This is what I'm saying now. And yet I'm already planning interconnected things from what I saw in the session 0. So I know that I'm already lying to myself. You don't have to tell me. But what we came up with as far as characters, we have a vexed dwarf rogue with the courtier background. We have a human wizard, and Chris is going to flesh him out. I think he ended up being a criminal, and I can't remember. Nomad criminal is what he picked for his other things there. We have a Northland elf druid with the envoy of winter background, an anointed elf warlock with the adherent background, and our supplicant human paladin with the vampire hunter background. Looking at all of these and knowing that we're using the Midgard setting, there are like lots of ties to either Morgal, which is the vampire nation, to Zobek, because that's where the winter embassy for the Shadowfey is at. So we're kind of looking at things that will make sense for that. We may end up running the Empire of the Ghouls adventure, which is kind of like a campaign. It's very similar to like the level range that a lot of the WotC adventures are, and it gives you like a big tour of a bunch of the Heartland region. The only thing that makes us a little bit hesitant is that that is a regular campaign, not just, you know, simple adventures one after another. So I will end up running it like a normal campaign, which I'm telling myself that I'm not going to. However, I do like the adventure, and I wouldn't mind running it.
Do you plan on expediting leveling up so we can experience, since we're only going to be playing once a month, are you going to try and expedite leveling a little bit so we can explore more of the game?
I mean, that's going to be another thing where, like, if we take Empire of the Ghouls, we'll probably be leveling up whenever that says we level up.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the way it's set up is each chapter usually gets you a level, but it's not necessarily like every session you would get a level.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, we'll kind of see. But I went way overboard adding stuff to Shard because now that I started customizing it, if you give me something to customize, I will literally lose, you know, 2 or 3 weeks of my life doing stuff like that. So,
I mean, I don't want to say I told you so, but I think I told you so about 2 years ago.
One of the things that I used to do all the time when I would do a session zero is go through and say, these are the books that I would like you to pull from. These are the, you know, the ancestries I'd like you to focus on and everything. And I don't have to do that in Shard because I can just allow the things that I want in the game. And that's all that shows up.
Yep. It's really nice.
I am really enjoying it and also burning a whole bunch of time customizing things for something that is only going to be a lightly engaged campaign for us to evaluate the game system. And then this Saturday I have my Curse of Strahd game. So the excitement there is that my daughter has a pool table in her basement and she got a cover for the pool table. So we're going to have this nice big surface to play on. And also I will be running a game in a basement for the first time since I was in high school.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
Moving on into the Dungeon Master's Workshop. During AD&D 1st and 2nd Edition, there were a ton of published campaign settings. Greyhawk, Ravenloft, Dragonlance, Forgotten Realms, Dark Sun, and so on. But from the beginning of 3rd Edition, whenever Wizards of the Coast has conducted a poll, the majority of DMs indicate that they're running a homebrew setting rather than a published setting. And that's also kind of been reflected in the number of settings that the company has published.
Mm-hmm.
So what does it really mean to make a homebrew setting? How much or how little gets incorporated into a homebrew setting? We wanted to talk a little bit about that today, based mostly on our personal experiences.
Also, I was terrible, and I threw together a poll at the very last minute, which means this week, so I didn't get a ton of responses, but I got over 50. And I was just asking people, like, do you make your campaigns completely from scratch? Do you assemble it from pieces, but all of the pieces are from something? Or do you do a little bit of both? Like, I made up this country, but this country I pulled in from something else. Basically, there's about 49% of people say that when they say homebrew, they mean they are making up the whole thing from scratch. 9% are doing it. And here's our comic book reference for this evening, Battle World style, because that was my term that I used because that's what happened in Secret Wars, where the Beyonder just yanked a bunch of planets together and shoved them into one. So about 9% of people do that, where almost everything in the campaign is recognizable as something, but not everything is from the same campaign setting. And then about 42% of the people said it's a little bit of both. So that's just giving you a baseline of what we were kind of looking at when we're starting this.
To start this off, let's steal a note from the definition panda and talk about what the core difference is between a homebrew setting and a published setting.
So I would say a homebrew setting is something that you are making up yourself. You're not going into a book and saying, here is the country of Furiondi or Cormyr, and there is a book that tells me how many people live here and what all the major cities are and what the geography is. You are actually making that stuff up yourself. You're coming up with your own names. You're deciding where the mountains are at, where the cities are at, who lives there. That is what a homebrew setting is versus a published setting.
Generally speaking, I agree. A homebrew setting is something that the GM is making up from scratch, out of whole cloth. Whole thing is from their head, made from nothing. Whereas a published setting is something that has been published in other books, in other media. And honestly, I think one of the biggest differences is the players can research the setting on their own if they can get access to the materials. Whereas a homebrew setting, the only research you're getting is by having a conversation with the GM about their world.
And it also leaves some room now which we were not encouraged to do back in our earliest days of gaming. But now it leaves a lot more room for a DM to be able to say, okay, I don't have where you're from detailed. What is it like? And pull your players into some of that world building as well.
Yeah, very much so. In my buddy Tristan's campaign world, I wanted to play a changeling, and he had not put changelings in the world. And rather than tell me no, he's like, let's talk about this. Let's figure out how changelings fit into this setting. And we came up with a really cool kind of mythology behind what changelings were and how they fit into the world. So what makes you decide to run a homebrew setting over a published setting?
Most recently, the first campaign that I tried to run for my daughter's group, I was essentially making it a homebrew setting. And I think part of that was because I didn't want to inundate them with too much lore. And I also know me, and I was worried that if I introduce this group to the Forgotten Realms, I am going to saturation bomb them with stuff, even if I don't mean to. And I was trying to curtail that by saying, okay, if I make this stuff myself, I can tell myself you are only detailing this region right now, and you are only pulling in these elements, and you don't have a 10,000 year timeline to reference. But on the other hand, the reason that I like running published settings is one of the things that is rewarding to me as a GM is I like knowing that certain settings are supposed to feel a certain way and that you are supposed to be able to hit certain themes. And if I feel like I am hitting those themes and using the tools that are in the setting, it is an extra level of reward for me beyond just having a good game session.
You also need to talk about the fact that a lot of people who enjoy running games enjoy world building.
Mm-hmm.
While you can get a little bit of that if you're running a published setting, you put your own spin on it regardless mm-hmm. of what's written down. If you have a desire to actually build your own fantasy world, that's a homebrew setting. You can create everything from scratch. There's also the times you may want to run something using D&D, but not necessarily all of the tropes from D&D. You want to give it a slightly different spin.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be easier to do that in a homebrew world than try and tell people that certain things don't exist or exist that shouldn't in a setting that has been published officially or through a secondary publisher.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also going to throw on a third reason. Because you're terrified of your players knowing more about the setting than you. I swore for years that I would never run Forgotten Realms because there was no way I could ever have the depth of knowledge that some of the people in my life have. It's why I latched on to Eberron. Eberron was new. All of us were starting at the same place.
Yeah.
Whereas Forgotten Realms, I have a friend who basically I can say XYZ about Forgotten Realms and he will be back with a response quite quickly. And I'm not talking about Jared. Jared is also that friend, but he's a newer friend. This is a friend I've known for years, decades, and I would have never volunteered to run Forgotten Realms for him in the past. Today, I'm a lot more confident, so I wouldn't hesitate. But back in the day, I'm like, oh no, I don't have the knowledge base
mm-hmm.
that the players do. I don't want to get anything wrong and upset them.
And it's funny, I believe that friend of yours is somebody that I used to talk to on Candlekeep about the Forgotten Realms.
Yep.
Oh, that is actually decades ago now, and that's kind of scary.
Yep. Yep. That friend has been an expert. Well, in my he would never call himself an expert. In my opinion, he has been an expert in Forgotten Realms lore since I met him in like 1991.
I do think that was something very wise that they did with Eberron, in that they said the source books are what the setting is. And even then, some of the source books don't tell you a definitive answer on things.
Yep.
And if we put out novels, these novels are only true to other novels. They are not true to the setting that anyone is running. Nobody is going to take stuff from these novels and put it in a source book.
Yep.
And as much as I love a lot of the Forgotten Realms novels that I read and the Dragonlance novels that I read, that is the thing that I think almost becomes more intimidating than the setting itself, is realizing that, you know, there are 98 books in this series.
Yeah, Eberron does a very good job of giving you the material of the world and then saying, here, go play. They have kept the timeline fairly static.
Mm-hmm.
I think they advanced the timeline a few years between third edition and fourth edition or something along those lines. But for the most part, they don't try and advance the timeline. Whereas, and this is no shade on Forgotten Realms, because there is value in having a world that continues to grow and you can, you know, reference the past and all of that. But Eberron gives GMs and players kind of the same starting point.
Yeah.
Where you can basically take what you know and use it, and you don't have to worry about whether or not things changed in a certain area, because if it's going to change, it's going to change because you play.
Yeah. There was actually something that Chris Perkins said about fifth edition that I thought was great. And the problem is I have never seen it in a book expressed this way. And that is, in an interview, he was talking about how the Forgotten Realms now, because you've had all of this stuff happen, like the sundering and planets getting shoved together and pulled apart and gods coming back to life and everything, the timeline is not the same as it used to be. It's like DC Comics after a crisis. Certain things did happen, but maybe not with all the details that they originally had. So going forward, their thought process in fifth edition was, the only thing that is true about the Forgotten Realms is what we publish in the fifth edition books. We might pull some stuff in from other editions, but until we do, that stuff doesn't necessarily have to have happened.
So what's your experience with homebrew settings?
My very first game that I ever ran was technically a homebrew setting. It was a nightmare, but I was also in middle school at the time when I did it.
I mean, a lot can be forgiven to middle schoolers. And I say this as somebody who was bullied in middle school. There's a lot that can be forgiven to middle schoolers.
I had, I got the expert set for the old, you know, the Beckme Dungeons and Dragons thing. By the time I was actually running, I had the expert set too, and I was pulling this stuff together. I liked the fact that Karameikos was in the expert set, but there was just kind of this vague notion of what the rest of the known world was that was, you know, the setting that became Mystara. I took Karameikos and plopped it into sort of the real world, but also like an alternate version of Earth where magic had not started to fade. So it was Earth, but an alternate Earth, but also had some countries that I was pulling in from D&D stuff. So that was my very first homebrew setting that I ran. I do not think the geography ever matched the actual Europe, but that's okay because it was an alternate Earth where magic never fully went away. So of course the geography doesn't have to be the same. I ran that for a while, and then I decided I wanted everyone to go to the Forgotten Realms because I got really excited about that box set when it came out. I actually introduced this plague that started getting rid of anything magical in the setting, so everybody had to flee to another setting. Because why not destroy the thing that I had created?
Why not? I have never run a homebrew campaign. I have played in homebrew campaigns, but I have never run one. What I have done is, when I have created a one-shot for D&D that is universally in a homebrew setting. Because when I do a one-shot, I really don't want to have the weight of a published setting behind it. The Lost Star of Windover, which is a one-shot I have run at various conventions, is very specifically my own little creation. And it's basically the Kingdom of Windover. The characters are all from the kingdom, associated with the queen, who is dying of some mysterious disease. And you and your compatriots have been sent off to find the lost star, which is to help you determine who is to be the next ruler of the kingdom. Very fairy tale type of stuff. I steal a lot from Stardust. You know, let's be honest here.
If you're going to steal stuff, you might as well steal from Stardust.
Yeah. One of the characters is the queen's son, who wasn't supposed to be heir, but his brother got himself exiled. The queen's adopted daughter, the queen's captain of the guard, the queen's old lover from when she was an adventurer, a cleric who is secretly associated with the queen's son, and a bard who knows way more than he should. All the characters are very associated, but it's basically create a setting that makes sense for these characters to have these interactions and go do a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I did the same thing when I ran a one-shot for my friend's kids last year at Origins. It was just, I don't want to have this tied to a setting. The kids wanted to try D&D. I'm going to give them the characters they want to play, and here's a setup. Go.
Yeah.
You know, you guys were an adventuring party. You had a teammate who decided he was going to retire from adventuring and marry the love of his life, but there was one last mission, and he died on that mission. And now it's a year and a half later, and you've been called back by his widow, and you arrive, and you realize that she had a child that you didn't know she was pregnant, but she had a child, and now the child has been kidnapped by your old enemy who has come back to life. It's all sort of dramatic BS, but it's like, I don't need to put that in the Forgotten Realms for a one-shot.
That is actually interesting, because I have noticed my urge to do something with homebrew actually goes up when it is brand new people. As much as I like certain settings, and even I will even think that I think this person would enjoy the setting or this person would enjoy this part of the setting, I don't necessarily want to do that for the first, like when I'm introducing all of the general D&D-isms, I don't want to also stack all of these setting things on top of it.
Yeah, when I ran for my niece and her friends, it was technically in the Forgotten Realms, but I only gave them enough lore to get them going. And honestly, they didn't need a whole lot of lore. They just wanted to punch stuff, or to quote my niece, bonk it in the head with her stick.
I was going to say, like, I could be snarky and say, like, the first half of 5th edition had that as its tagline, technically in the Forgotten Realms. we're going to shove the Tomb of Annihilation and a Sararak from Greyhawk into the Forgotten Realms, but it's technically in the Forgotten Realms. We're going to have the Elemental Princes from Greyhawk, but technically it's in Forgotten Realms.
If you are going to run a homebrew setting, what do you need to have in place to comfortably run a campaign?
This is definitely going to vary based on different people. I think there are different answers if you have never run something before versus if you have run something before. Like if you have run something and you have been a DM using an established setting before versus somebody that has always homebrewed. I think at a bare minimum, you need to be able to answer questions that come up because D&D is D&D.
Mm-hmm.
At the very least, you need to be able to answer, clerics get powers from somewhere. Are there gods? Is it mysterious? Is there a chance that there aren't gods? Do they interact with the world or not? It is a big question, and it may not affect your first level adventure, but it does kind of affect that cleric and the religion that they come from.
Yeah.
If their god's showing up every other week, that's a lot different than no one has heard from this deity for 2,000 years.
With this question, one of the things you have to be careful of is overwhelming yourself trying to set everything up
mm-hmm.
before the campaign begins.
Yeah.
Because if you are trying to run a published setting, you can just go read a book to find out what's in the country over the next border, or what's across that sea, or what's in those woods. If you're running a homebrew setting, that's all got to come from you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my buddy Tristan's world, I think the name is Sailua. He's been creating this world since the 1980s. So this is a world he has continually developed and built on over time. So he has a deep breadth of knowledge and lore in his setting, but that's not something he created overnight. It's something he added to as he needed it. So I think to comfortably begin a campaign, you need to know, where do the PCs come from? If all your players want to start in the same town or village, great. But if you have your seventh warrior who wants to come from a different culture far away, well, you and that player are going to have to sit down and establish, where is that place? Mm-hmm. What are those people like? Why is that character here? And then you need to establish, at least loosely, what is your campaign going to be about? What are the characters going to be doing? Where are they going to be going? You can totally do a sandbox and just let the players find stuff and make it up as they go. Or you can, you know, have an idea of where you want things to head and have pieces in place that you can move. You don't need to have absolutely everything in place at once. You need to be able to develop it as your players start to explore. We've all heard stories of GMs who have spent tireless hours toiling over their keyboard, typing up parts of this world that their players will never, ever see. And maybe that GM will be one in a million who gets a book published, but probably not.
And honestly, if you enjoy that, that's fine, but don't put the pressure on yourself to think you have to do that before you can run a game. I'm a big fan of, and I think Dragons of Icespire Peak is actually kind of set up this way. I am a fan of, here is your home base, here is a mission board, here are some location where there are some missions. And that's really all you need to begin with.
Yep. Figure out what you want the campaign to be about, or the general gist of it as you start, and build what you need to run that. And you can totally be like my buddy Tristan and start keeping a notebook that you add the developed parts of this world to it so you can create the world over time.
It is kind of funny because if you look at two well-known names in D&D, you see two very different approaches. Because if you look at Gygax, Gygax was very much the, I am making this dungeon. I don't care what's outside this dungeon. Oh, wait. They need to go somewhere and rest and buy new torches? Okay, I'm going to make a city next to the dungeon. And on the other hand, you have Ed Greenwood, who from the time he was like 10 years old, has been making up these stories in the Forgotten Realms and adding tons and tons of stuff on top of these layers that he is building. And oh yeah, I could put my D&D setting in here too.
Yep.
The other thing that I was going to say, though, that's interesting, because we talked about that whole, you know, the home base, job board, where the missions are at, or like the nearby dungeon or whatever. I think it's interesting to look at the fact that many D&D adventures actually are settings, even when you don't think about it.
Mm-hmm.
A setting doesn't necessarily have to be the entire world. And when you look at something that is just telling you, like, here's the moat house and down the road is the Temple of Elemental Evil, that's not the whole Greyhawk setting. And the whole Greyhawk setting didn't exist when they first started that. But that is Hamlet and the Moat House and then the Temple of Elemental Evil and the fields where all the battles took place.
Yeah. Running Dragon Heist. It's Waterdeep.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you a lot of information on the city of Waterdeep. It's designed specifically around the idea of this is the adventure that characters are on. So it's not detailing the whole city, but it's giving you pieces of the city that you can use for that adventure.
I have heard, and this is much different than in third edition, because I think in third edition, there is a lot more of a drive that I am not going to say this adventure takes place in Waterdeep because then people will assume things are true about the setting.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I have heard a lot more people now say, I just plopped Waterdeep into the setting that I'm running things in. I don't know what's down the road from Waterdeep, but Waterdeep was in Dragon Heist and that's what I'm running. Whatever else is in the setting is there from whatever else I made up.
Yeah, I find it interesting that Wizards of the Coast has done different things with their adventure books. For example, Dragon Heist, it's in Waterdeep. Storm King's Thunder, it's in the north. Keys of the Golden Vault, you can plop those adventures anywhere you want.
Yeah.
They've done a little bit of different things there. So when running homebrew, to what degree do you incorporate D&D lore? And I don't mean like setting lore. I mean actual D&D lore, because the base game itself has a degree of lore built in.
This is what's interesting, because I have made this joke so many times in the last, you know, year or so, that Jeremy Crawford has started saying the multiverse is the setting. But that actually is kind of true, because when I made that homebrew setting for my daughter's group, the world was not an established world. I was making the stuff as it went along. There's this village that is governed, or actually there's three villages that are governed by a druid circle. There was, you know, this forest where there's Shadar Kai that naturally fades in and out of the Shadowfell. et cetera, et cetera. But the crux of the thing was looking for the Eye of Vecna, because Vecna, even though he came from Greyhawk, is sort of a thing that exists in D&D as a whole.
Yep.
He is a D&Dism. He is famous. He may be from Greyhawk. He appeared in Critical Role. He was a major part of Critical Role, even though he's not part of Exandria as a setting.
The answer to what degree do you incorporate D&D lore depends on what you are trying to do with your homebrew setting. If you are trying to do something unique that is not straight D&D, the quote-unquote generic fantasy that we all associate with D&D, then you're going to have to pick and choose. Are trolls exactly what we expect and, you know, vulnerable to fire?
Mm.
Are goblins the most common low-level monster you see around? You're going to have to decide what fits your world, and not all of the basic D&D lore, specifically with a lot of the monsters, is something you're going to want to incorporate. But that's something you have to decide.
It's actually really interesting when you look back at even published settings with what TSR had played with some of this, because I will swear up and down, there are definitely differences between Dragonlance and Greyhawk and the Forgotten Realms, but there's also a lot of stuff that, if you say it, it is probably true for all three of those.
Yes.
But there were a couple settings that TSR put out that were really like, yeah, it's D&D, but don't assume anything. And one of those was Dark Sun. Dark Sun was not something where you could assume anything to be like it was in other settings. And the other one was Birthright. And Birthright was a lot more, it was almost more folklore-ish. Like, on one hand, it was about ruling domains and, you know, running entire kingdoms, but it was also like, elves were more secluded and they didn't deal with humans a lot. There were a handful of unique dragons. There were not, you know, red and blue and all of these things. So both of those things couldn't just assume that you're going to see a beholder or something like that, because that may not be true.
I would caution somebody who wants to go this path, because you can kind of build yourself a trap by trying to be too unique.
Yes.
There are times where you can frustrate your players because you are trying to go so far off script from D&D. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying be prepared for what you're getting yourself into. Oh, I don't know how long ago. I had a friend who wanted to try and run a D&D campaign where we started in this kind of underworld location because something, some cataclysmic thing had happened and everyone had retreated to these this cavernous underground, and we were starting to like go out and peek at the rest of the world. And it was a very neat idea, but I think he was kind of writing himself into a corner.
Yeah.
So we only ended up playing a couple of sessions of that before it kind of fell to the wayside. And I think it was because he had tried to do too much that changed the core nature of what D&D is.
I think 5th edition is a very flexible rule set. I think it actually is more flexible than some people give it credit for when they get frustrated that it gets used as a baseline for a lot of things, because I honestly think it's a little bit better for that than 3rd edition was when that was getting used as a baseline for everything.
Mm-hmm.
However, D&D, like if you give somebody a player's handbook and say, this is what we're assuming, there's a lot of assumptions that you can extrapolate from that player's handbook. And the more you're deviating from those extrapolations, the more you're probably causing some issues with what players are going to want to be able to do.
I'll be honest, there are games out there that are designed to be quote-unquote replacements for D&D. And 9 times out of 10 when I play these, I start feeling like I'd really rather just be playing D&D. But at the same time, the ideas that some people have for doing campaigns that are different than the core concepts of D&D, there are other game systems out there that might work better for what you're trying to do and disconnect your players from their expectations that are built into D&D.
Yeah, I agree. The other thing that I think is interesting, though, is when you even look at other companies that have tried to distance themselves from D&D, but not entirely. They want to still produce the feel of D&D, but do their own thing. Pathfinder, whatever you might think of Galarian and all the specifics of those countries and everything is there, the baseline assumptions of Pathfinder were they created outer planes that pretty much matched the Great Wheel cosmology. There was a hell and there was an abyss and there was the Hades, and like they renamed a few of them, but it was basically like, this is the big ticket stuff that people assume exists in the cosmos. So we are going to not try and rock the boat too much and just recreate it.
I will say Pathfinder is not one of those games that I played and thought I would rather just be playing D&D. Because there was a period of time where Pathfinder was my D&D. To name names, Dungeon World.
Yeah.
I don't enjoy Dungeon World. I would just rather play D&D. And I know that's heresy to a lot of people who absolutely adore Dungeon World. For those that don't know, Dungeon World is a powered by the apocalypse version of exploring dungeons and having that those fantasy tropes you see in D&D.
Yeah, and to cross-promote something. By the time you hear this, my interview with Rob Heinzu is out in the Gnomecast, and we're talking about 13th Age there. 13th Age is another one that I feel like it embraces a lot of D&D-isms, but it is also very much its own thing with its own personality. When I played it, I was not sitting there going, I would rather be playing D&D, because it felt different, but at the same time, if you tell someone you're playing a ranger or you're playing a sorcerer, you get what that means based on what you know from D&D.
We've talked about the basic D&D lore that comes just purely out of the player's handbook, the Dungeon Master's Guide, and the Monster Manual, but what about actual published setting material? Is it fair to incorporate any of that into a homebrew setting?
I think that is going to depend on the players that you have, because on one hand, you're absolutely correct. It is a nightmare for a GM to have to deal with somebody that will point out and say, no, there can't be an inn on this corner because I know that in Waterdeep, this particular intersection has a smithy right here. That is something you do not want to deal with as a DM. On the other hand, it's kind of fair that if somebody vaguely knows what Waterdeep is and they say, oh, so it's divided into Castle Ward and Sea Ward and there's a walled in area that is all just one giant cemetery, you kind of want to not yank that rug out from under them, because Waterdeep has a certain definition that people kind of assume, and I don't think that's unreasonable. So when I say you can pull stuff into a homebrew setting, I think you also need to understand what everyone expects out of the stuff that you're pulling into the setting and dropping there.
I think you are completely well within your rights to find a thing in a published setting that you think would work well in your game and pull it out and transplant it. You can file off the serial numbers and change the names. Something like Waterdeep is going to be a little bit more recognizable, but something like the town of Black Pit in Eberron, nobody knows what the hell Black Pit is.
Yeah.
In fact, when I ran my original Eberron campaign, Black Pit has like three lines in some of the source material, but I made an entire living, breathing town based on those few lines. So does that make that a published setting, or does that make that homebrew?
I mean, this is actually kind of why I wanted to talk about this topic, because I've heard this come up a couple times where people say, well, if they're polling people and the majority of people that play D&D do not use published settings, why does WotC still put out published settings?
Well, they're still selling.
Well, they're selling, but also, you know, my conjecture is exactly what we're talking about. Even when people homebrew, they use things. They're still toolboxes. They may not use the entire toolbox full of tools, but they're still toolboxes that are useful to them for certain things. And I agree with what you're saying. Like, if I pulled like Mirabar out of the Forgotten Realms, I don't think most people are going to think that, you know, a town run by a dwarven trading consortium that also has humans living there that is in the, you know, this cold northern climate absolutely could only have come from the Forgotten Realms.
My friend Jen, who ran for me the Tyranny of the Dragon Queen campaign, she didn't like the city that it was set in. So she made her own city. It's like this very mix and match homebrew published setting stuff. As I mentioned earlier, Keys of the Golden Vault. There is no reason you can't take those adventures and plop them where you want and fine-tune them to fit your setting. Take what you want. It's your world. It's your game.
And I think the other thing that is important to point out is that this is a fun, creative exercise for a lot of people. When I say that, I mean, sometimes people like to play what if. And I'm not talking about making an entire, like, 2,000-page setting Bible for your setting or anything like that. But as an example, when Dragon Magazine was putting out, like, the adventure paths, like the Age of Worms and things like that, they had conversion materials that were being written by different people that were, you know, were experts in different settings that would convert it from Greyhawk to Eberron or from Greyhawk to the Forgotten Realms. And I loved reading those, not just because I was thinking, oh, someday I'm going to run this. It was more like, oh, that's right. This is a theme that is true of this and is true of this. And I just liked seeing the thought process that people ran through. And sometimes even just seeing that thought process even expands your toolbox. Like when you start realizing, oh, yeah, this is the same sort of thing as this. So I can use something that is vaguely like this in this circumstance.
When I was running the Depths of Zendrick campaign, there's a whole book talking about Zendrick. It is not giving you a whole lot of detail for a whole ass continent. When I'm running the exploration phase of that game, I am completely making up 95% of what the players are finding in those woods, in that jungle. You know, I'm like, okay, I think this is going to be some cool stuff for them to find on this journey. How much of that work is me using a published setting and how much of it is homebrew?
Mm-hmm.
If you dig down into it, even the people who are using published settings are still doing a lot of work on their own. And a lot of the people who say they're homebrewing are borrowing a lot from existing material.
Yeah. The city that all of you are in the Midgard campaign, Accolon, I think it might have 3 paragraphs in the world book. Someone else's Accolon may not look anything like the city that you all are adventuring in, because I have been building out what I want it to look like. And I've also been taking stuff like when you interact with an NPC or when you tell me that this person was important to you or that this kind of person exists in the city, I've been trying to find a place for them and make sure that that is an important part of the city. Honestly, I would say this is something I don't hear as much now, but it was the bane of my existence in the third edition era. There were people that would get very haughty about, well, I homebrew. I don't need the crutch of an existing published setting. And that would bother me so much because I'm sitting here thinking, especially at the time, this is third edition, no one knew what I'm about to say, but I'm sitting here thinking, I just put in 20 hours worth of prep for a 4-hour game session. Get out of here telling me that I need a crutch because I am using a specific game setting.
Yeah. I mean, one of my thoughts during this topic was the, you know, I've never created a homebrew campaign setting. I don't have time to completely create that homebrew setting and give it the level of time and dedication it would need.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I'm going to happily rely on the crutch of picking and pulling and using whatever piece I find is useful for my games.
If you homebrew your setting, you are a wonderful person and I respect you. If you use a published setting, you are a wonderful person and I respect you, because I know both of you are doing the work to run a game for people that will enjoy the game that you are presenting to them.
Yep. And to be completely honest, in today's life, you have to find your balance of what's going to work for you.
Yeah, I don't think that using a published setting, in my case, is me doing less work to customize it. It is more putting up guardrails where I start saying, no, I'm not going to design that country that is 3,000 miles away just because I made up an NPC that is a merchant from there.
I gotta tell you, we use a lot of fiction, especially fantasy fiction, as reference kind of guideposts for doing fantasy creation. There's a whole lot of authors out there that name a place and don't actually detail any of it until they actually need to write about it. They might have those 3 lines written down in a notebook somewhere that are relevant to the story they're telling right now, but until the characters need to go to that place or they need to interact more with that place isn't getting detailed. Slight side tangent. It is hilarious to me when you have toxic fans who start making stuff up about a place or a thing or a person an author has mentioned but hasn't detailed. And then when several books later, several movies later, whatever, it does get detailed and those toxic fans are mad because it doesn't match their headcanon.
Yeah.
It's like, come on, people.
I extrapolated so much from these two sentences. The other thing that I was going to say about this topic in general, too, is at some point we need to have Chris back on here, because now all of you out there should be able to listen to the Heroes of Hovel's Way, which is the campaign that Ange and I are playing and that Chris is running for us. And that is a homebrew setting. Some of this has been what Chris wants to do, like the big picture thing, like the threats and, you know, how this, you know, the supernatural works. And some of this has been stuff that we came up with that he has incorporated. Like, what does it mean to be a Circle of Stars druid in this setting? You know?
Yes.
How can I make my paladin look as much like D'Artagnan as possible and make it work for the setting?
Chris very much sat us down, found out what we wanted to play, and then worked with us to make those characters with those chosen classes and subclasses fit within the campaign setting for the game we're playing. And to reiterate what Jared said, you should go listen to the Heroes of Hovel's Way, because at this point, two episodes will be out.
Yes.
You can hear us in character, actually playing. Jared and I get to play together. Do you know how rare that is?
It's usually one of us trying to kill the other one. No, that you shouldn't be an adversarial GM.
Neither of us are adversarial GMs.
We're not.
I think you can say we're both cream puffs.
Yeah. I felt bad when I knocked a squirrel out.
I mean, who knew the squirrel was vulnerable to Cone of Cold?
Speaking of catching someone in multiple area effects in the same turn.
So I think we've covered everything in about homebrew settings that we really want to touch on.
Yes, I am sure all of our listeners now could make an entire world and be very, very comfortable doing it now.
Or borrow the parts they want and make it their own.
Oh, yeah, that's what they should do.
No time for rest, you two. Get on with your downtime research.
Every episode, we're going to look for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to our listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience.
This is our Patreon show. We have a Patreon now. So if you'd like to help us do this show and provide some additional content for you, we'd love it if you decide to join. We've got our own Discord, and we'll be releasing additional supplementary material like the map Chris made for the campaign for Heroes of Hovel's Way. It is at patreon.com/thackzerowa.
And speaking of supplementary material, there should be, as of the time that you're listening to this, if you join the Patreon, you also will get access to a worksheet that I made for detailing what you need to have to build out your setting. The fact that I would be thinking about that before we did an episode is just amazing.
I'm shocked.
But yeah, I did make up a worksheet, and I would be very happy if you would join us on the Patreon and look at my worksheet and pat me on the back and validate me.
The thing I wanted to share is recently on John Bernthal's podcast, The Real Ones, he interviewed Deborah Ann Wall. Now, just as a frame of reference, John Bernthal played the Punisher in Daredevil and Punisher for the Netflix series, and Deborah Ann Wall was in Daredevil, and I'm a horrible person. I can't remember the name of her character.
Karen Page.
Yes, Karen Page. Both fantastic. But Deborah is a D&D nerd, and so they spent some time on the podcast talking about Dungeons & Dragons. There is an 8-minute clip from the show that we are going to share, we're going to link in our show notes, that brilliantly shows how to introduce someone to RPGs and D&D. Basically, they start talking about it. She asks him if he wants to play, and he's like, yeah, sure, I guess so. And she's like, no, I mean right now. And they basically start going through a scene where he's in the woods with a bow and a sword on his side, and there's something in the woods, and what do you do? And I'd have you roll this. And it was just, it was so brilliant on how it demonstrates what D&D was in. And the sheer engagement that you see from Bernthal is brilliant. And it doesn't hurt that I'd watch the two of them in almost anything. It's short. It's about 8 minutes. It's worth a watch. Go check it out.
Yeah, Deborah Ann Wall is just so enthusiastic about D&D. If you've ever seen her running anything or talking about D&D, she is such a good ambassador for the game.
Yes.
Because she just loves it so much.
Yeah.
In the proud tradition of using the space to introduce our audience to expensive 50th anniversary dice sets, on Hasbro Pulse, there is a new 50th anniversary dice set called the Then and Now set. This particular set has one set of dice in yellow, red, white, green, and blue, and then another set that is in those same colors but sparkly. Why is this a 50th anniversary set? Because the set that isn't sparkly does not have the numbers inked, and it has a crayon that you can use to ink the numbers on the dice.
That's adorable. It's probably too expensive to be adorable, but that's adorable.
Yeah, it's $50. So, I mean, it's $50 worth of adorable. But if you want to relive that feeling of taking out that crayon to fill in your numbers, then for the low price of $50, you could do this and just feel great about yourself again.
We are happily part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamers podcast to check out, like
Panda's Talking Games. Queer gamers talking about tabletop role-playing games and making outtakes. Join Panda's Phil and Senda every other Wednesday, answering listener questions about playing, running, and designing TTRPGs. It's like Car Talk, but for your games.
We've used up all our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you, and we hope you'll go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.